today. Cliff Lamb and I came in together. We were graduate students here together, and it's my first trip back to Manhattan for 20 years. And Sandra suggested maybe I've reached the limits of my probation period. I could finally come back. But what a joy it's been driving around and seeing the area. I told Cliff you could drop me off here somewhere, and I'd have no idea where I was. So much has changed. It's just a great opportunity to be here, and I'm really, really thankful for the committee to invite me to come back and share some of this information with you. I want to tell you just a little bit about the Range Cattle Research and Education Center, where we're at. I don't have a diagram of Florida up here, but starting in the end of the fall, I'll be beginning my 20th year there at the University of Florida. Florida's kind of a unique state for beef cattle production. It's about 1 million mama cows, and a little over 80% of those are south of the I-4 corridor. And that corridor runs from Tampa over to Cape Canaveral, if you kind of think of where that is in South Florida. It's a tropical, subtropical production system, and it's a very dense area of beef cows. Although Florida only would average about number 11, 12, or 13 in the nation for total number of beef cows, about like Colorado or Iowa, they're number one in the U.S. for the number of herds with over 2,500 head of mama cows. And all of those herds, with the exception of two, maybe three, are south of that I-4 corridor, so all in that area. Now, that's kind of unique in itself, but what's even more unique is that we don't have a single feedlot down there and no traditional stocker operations. There might be a few small backgrounding operations. And so almost all of those calves are born in the late fall, early winter, November, December, January, about that 90-day period. The vast majority would be born, and then they're all trucked out of the state, most of them weaned right on the truck, right before our tropical season, which is July and August. So right now we're ending our weaning season. I heard John say that they had about 10 inches of rainfall a year. We have about 60 inches of rainfall a year, but it all comes at that time period. And then, as some of you might know, then we complain about drought. How can we have drought with 60 inches of rain a year? So I always tell people that we live in perpetual drought with frequent flooding. And that's what it continues to be. So in the summertime, you know, we're flooded and we try to have those calves out. But what was an interest to me, because I was able to be introduced and studied trace minerals when I was here at Kansas State, is that Florida has a rich history with published research on trace mineral nutrition of grazing beef cattle. We have some really interesting trace mineral imbalances in Florida. I'm going to introduce some of those to you now and introduce others around the country. And you might see how they might fit into your type of production situation. So this is kind of how I've divided it up. And I wanted to give you some introduction to macro minerals. But most people, when they think about reproduction, they're interested in trace minerals. So we're going to focus most of our time on that. But I'll give you an introduction there. And then I want to spend some time with antagonists. That's something that I know all of you are familiar with. I want to talk to you about some of the modern problems that we're having with antagonists, particularly focusing on sulfur, and then explain to you a little bit about mineral source. Now, one thing I'm not going to have time with is probably the most important thing. It's a very practical thing. How do you get minerals into your beef cows? So methods of supplementation. Now, I tried to hit that pretty good in my proceedings article, and you can read about it there, but I'll also be around the rest of the day and at the event tonight. And if you'd like to talk about mineral supplementation, methods to get it into cows, I would like to do that, because that is the most important practical approach in terms of optimizing and dealing with mineral nutrition in the grazing cow herd. So when we think about reproduction, I've tried to take this talk and focus on reproduction, because that's the general theme of this conference, is that in almost every situation, the mineral nutrition, that direct effect of mineral nutrition on reproduction, it's almost always secondary to something else. Almost always. The direct effect of a mineral deficiency on reproduction is quite rare. It's almost always secondary to something else. And I'm going to try to explain that and introduce that to you as we go along. But we can generally put these into three different categories of how minerals impact all physiological processes, but ultimately reproduction in beef cows, and that's these. Antioxidant capacity. So the trace elements I'm going to introduce to you have very strong antioxidant functions, and I'll explain how that could impact reproduction. And then I'm going to show you some new data, some things that we've really started to understand about copper and the direct effects that molybdenum has on reproduction, and probably why there's been quite a bit of confusion about copper and the link to reproduction over a number of years. And then, of course, growth rate, just reduced vigor. When we think about some of the macro minerals and how those, albeit rare in a lot of improved agricultural practices, they still exist. They generally would contribute to poor growth, poor vigor. And then ultimately, of course, that would impact reproduction. So the macro minerals that I'm going to talk about are just your major ones. And I want to focus on issues such as the calcium-phosphorus ratio. But a lot of these, like calcium, phosphorus, magnesium, potassium, they relate very closely with nerve function, right? Nerve development and nerve function. And then this issue of osmotic balance. So the cow has a remarkable ability to have this very closely and tightly regulated acid-base balance, all right? And a lot of you know about this with dairy cows, and particularly veterinarians in the crowd when they're talking about milk fever. We don't generally think about milk fever in beef cows, but it is this acid-base balance that causes this response. And so I'll introduce that a little bit. So in the title, we talked about magic and mystery, and there's no magic, but there certainly is some mystery. But one of the things I always try to tell people is that the satisfy their needs. So I always hear producers say, John, my cows are eating a lot of mineral. They must be short in something. Or alternatively, and probably worse, they'll say, John, my cows aren't eating any mineral, so they must be satisfied. They must have all the mineral that they need. Neither of those are true. The cow has no idea what she needs. None at all. She only has the nutritional wisdom to consume salt to meet and exceed her sodium requirement. That's it. So if you ever wondered about that, how many of you know about grass tetany and rapidly growing lush spring pastures? And we relate this to magnesium deficiency, right? But if you took cows that were succumbing to death because of grass tetany and you put magnesium oxide out for them, they would never eat it. They would die before they would eat it. They don't know what they need. They only eat that free choice mineral to satisfy their salt craving, and they'll far exceed that amount. And so, surprisingly, for many years, we use this idea of putting salt in our mineral to encourage intake and to limit intake. And so keep that in mind, and I'm not going to be able to spend a lot of time talking about that, but in terms of these methods of supplementation, but that's a really important factor and one I hope that you would understand. So generally, salt intake will increase as the forage moisture content increases. So generally, in the summertime or when we have lush, high-moisture forages, cows crave sodium more. They'll eat more salt. And you can also see that with cows that are consuming baleage or silage versus dry hay. They will consume more free-choice salt when they consume that higher moisture forage. And then salt intake will often decrease. Voluntary free-choice intake will often decrease in the wintertime when you feed an energy and protein supplement. So I'm really on a bandwagon right now with my producers trying to encourage them to mix their mineral supplement into their winter supplement so that it can be fed at the amount that you want. Don't give that cow an opportunity to decide what she wants to eat. Feed it to her. It's called controlled mineral feeding, and it's something that works quite well. So calcium, almost all of the calcium in the body is stored in bones. And those of you that remember your basic animal nutrition, it's that ability to remobilize that calcium that is really important for maintaining calcium homeostasis. And so if you ever have issues related to calcium imbalance, it's generally related to structural problems and generally related to bone issues. And it's something that we don't run into that much. Now, low calcium, or rather this imbalance in calcium and phosphorus, can lead to urinary calculi. And some of you probably have run into that. In my part of the world, it's something that we rarely see. And there are times that you can see where low calcium can cause grass tetany. There are issues related to that. But it's something that I very, very rarely run into. So maintenance of calcium homeostasis, that is really critical. And I've had some producers and veterinarians and researchers point out that there might be a chance that beef cattle herds suffer in some cases, to maybe a subclinical milk fever issue because of the amount of milk that some of our beef cows are producing. So to overcome that, it certainly is important that we have calcium and phosphorus balanced well to allow for that remobilization. So if calcium loss exceeds the body to replenish it or remobilize it, that's when you would run into this milk fever issue. Now, when I get into phosphorus, and I only have two slides or maybe three on it, I want to talk a little bit more about this. So of the macro minerals, phosphorus is probably the most important. Probably is. It's certainly the most expensive. So unless you're feeding a mineral supplement that has a lot of fancy bells and whistles in it, phosphorus is the largest factor contributing to the cost of your mineral supplement. Now, a lot of producers would say for quite some time that I don't really care if I'm feeding too much phosphorus. I want to make sure that they have enough because they remember back when their grandfathers were saw enormous responses on rangelands and these perennial grazing pastures when phosphorus was supplemented. These really enormous responses they saw in heifer growth and calf growth. But today, I would tell you that almost all locations, in most locations, overfeed phosphorus. We feed too much. Now, in some parts of the country, that could have some environmental concerns. But for all of us, it has economic concerns. And so I would encourage you to look at the amount of phosphorus that cattle are consuming and look at what you're supplementing. You might be supplementing too much. I'm certainly not saying that it's hurting the animals, but it might be an economic issue. And we feed a lot of byproducts now that we probably didn't feed before that are often high in phosphorus. And so to meet that calcium-phosphorus balance of about 2-to-1, at least 1-to-1 at the very least, we probably have to come in and supplement additional limestone or additional calcium to bring that balance up, just because of the phosphorus content of some of these byproduct feeds. So of all of the macro minerals, phosphorus is involved in more biological functions than any of the others. And phosphorus, I don't want you to get the idea that it's not important, but it is very important, particularly for proper ruminal function. But in almost all cases with growing forage or forage that's in its vegetative state, will almost always deliver enough phosphorus on a dry matter basis. It's very, very seldom that a beef cow would require more than 0.18 or 0.2% phosphorus in the total diet on a dry matter basis unless she's in early lactation. And it's those times of her life that she may be able to mobilize enough to really get along as well. Now, Lee McDowell always brings this up, and even now when I tell people that cattle do not have a nutritional wisdom to consume anything but salt, okay, to meet their requirement. And he'll tell me they have a nutritional wisdom to consume phosphorus. That is true. But it has to be at extreme phosphorus deficiencies. And this is called pica or pica, depending on who says the word. And it's just a condition where cattle will seek out ashes. Sometimes they'll seek out bones. They'll chew on wood. And they may be suffering from phosphorus deficiency. But I would challenge that's very, very rare in the United States. And so what I want to tell you is think about this calcium-phosphorus ratio and the dietary contributions of each. Think about the phosphorus contribution from the byproducts that you're feeding and try to keep it at least a 1-to-1 ratio. All right? Most nutritionists are already doing that and are recognizing that. Okay. And some cereal grains, by the way, may be very high in calcium. And that'll be an opportunity for you to look at phosphorus. So magnesium. For many of us in the Southeast, magnesium's kind of boring because we really don't have that grass tetany issue. But it's second only to potassium in terms of its cation function and that cation-anion balance to buffer the animal's acid balance. Deficiencies very uncommon, except when cattle are grazing those spring high growth situations. All right, and so that's a time when you really want to look at supplementing magnesium, generally in a controlled feeding situation, either through feed or a lick tub, to make sure that you protect against grass tetany. And typically, if forage levels are greater than 0.2% magnesium, which for many of you that is the case, except for that one time of year, additional magnesium isn't important. Potassium also is a strong participant in this cation-anion balance. It is a cation, and we use it a lot to balance against high sulfur. I'm going to show you that in the next couple of slides. But we rarely ever supplement it during the growing season when forage is in its vegetative state. It's really uncommon to see potassium to be deficient. Almost always our range grasses will meet throughout the United States, meet the potassium requirements of an adult beef cow. It may be inadequate, however, in stored forage, particularly dried forage, or in stockpiled forage. It could be inadequate. If those animals are consuming an energy and protein supplement at that time, which most all of the time they are, then it probably is delivering adequate potassium just from background values. So I wanted to spend a little more time with the last macro element, and that's sulfur. Now, sulfur is an essential amino acid or essential mineral, and it's primarily required for the essential sulfur-containing amino acids, methionine and cysteine. All right, but almost always our basal feedstuffs will provide enough to support both the vitamin, sulfur-containing vitamin functions, as described here, and these amino acid, sulfur-containing amino acid production. So in grazing beef cattle, a deficiency is unlikely. But on the other side, we can be getting large amounts of sulfur in our cattle and be causing problems. Of the antagonists that I'm going to present in a minute, sulfur is by far the most important one for us to consider. So generally, anything over 0.2% sulfur on a dry matter basis in a cow's diet is adequate for any needs that she would have. There are times, many times, that our cows consume more than that, and they may be consuming as much as 0.3 or 0.35 or more percent sulfur in the diet. When that happens, we have an antagonistic situation for these trace elements. I want to spend some time talking to you about that. I think it might be one of the most important parts of the information that I want to deliver. So, of the microminerals, the three that are the most important are copper, zinc, and selenium. Now, selenium might not be important to you depending on where you are, and I'll spend a little bit of time introducing that. Now, there are other elements, microelements, particularly manganese, and cobalt. They're also important, and they're generally low or deficient in some forages, but they're very easy to supplement. And functions that can be impacted by their deficiency are quite rare in most grazing situations. So whenever I think about zinc, I often tell people, think about rapidly dividing cells. Whatever tissues or organs or physiological functions that would require rapidly dividing cells, that's where you would think of zinc being important. So hoof integrity, skin integrity, spermatogenesis, humoral immune responses to vaccines, responses that require rapidly dividing cells, zinc is important. And so I'm going to show you a couple slides that relate this to spermatogenesis in bulls. Interestingly, it's the second most abundant trace element found in almost all organisms, second only to iron. So let's talk about spermatogenesis for a minute. Here's some data that I pulled out that we did here in Kansas State quite some time ago, where bulls, developing young bulls, were receiving at that time what was the requirement for growing bulls, I think 30 part per million zinc, or they received zinc from a mixture of organic and inorganic zinc, or they received a high level of inorganic zinc. And then this is just the percent of bulls that were classification deferred. And that meant that they failed their first breeding soundness exam at 12 months of age. That didn't mean that they didn't pass it at an older age. And when we fed the NRC required amount of zinc at 40 part per million, in this case, they had a greater number of bulls that failed compared to the higher level of zinc at 60 part per million. Others have come in and published more recent data showing that bulls that receive organic sources of zinc at, in this case, they received 450 milligrams a day. That would probably be about 45 part per million, maybe 40 part per million, depending on how much they consumed of the total diet, that they had greater indices of sperm motility when they receive the organic form of zinc. So it's not uncommon today to see young growing animals, particularly bulls, being fed a diet that contains higher amounts of zinc or maybe more bioavailable forms of zinc. Now, in terms of selenium and copper, I put these together because they're uniquely important. One is that they cooperate together in the strongest antioxidant function in the body. In your bodies, our cows, or anything. They are the most powerful antioxidant enzymes of all. And so that's probably the point where they really are important. In most parts of the United States, all of our perennial forages are deficient in both selenium and copper. And so that's something I find them to be unique. And lastly, they are strongly antagonized by sulfur. And so this is also something that's important to keep in mind. So here's the issue. When we have reactive oxygen species, these are those free radicals that you might hear about, they are converted to water by two steps. One step requires copper, and that's superoxide dismutase. That creates hydrogen peroxide. And then the next step requires glutathione peroxidase. That's selenium dependent, and that reduces it to water. This is a very normal biological function that if we are short in either of these, it could result in problems. And then this issue of selenium deficiency in calves. Veterinarians and producers know this as white muscle disease, and that's the clinical form of the disease. But I believe that there's probably more issues related to subclinical selenium deficiency that might be related to this weak calf syndrome. These are calves that just don't have that muscle integrity, that vigor to get up and suckle soon after birth, could be related to low selenium status in our cows and calves, and also related to this uterine involution issue because of the lack of tissue integrity that these elements would be an important part of. So again, this is that secondary function that I'm talking about that's not necessarily directly related to the lack of that element. I show you this slide here because these are some heifers weaned from our cow herd at Florida, and you can see those selenium levels decreasing in what I would consider a well-supplemented cow herd. And that's for two reasons. Number one, milk is a very poor source of selenium, and the calves then only have access to what selenium's in the forage, which is almost devoid. And then lastly, calves don't eat much of that free-choice salt-based mineral. You might see them at the feeder, but they're not consuming much. And so we almost always wean calves that are marginally selenium deficient, even in well-managed herds. And this area of research is something that we're really focused on. Now, if you look at where Kansas is here, this is selenium content of the soil. Now, this is interesting because all these other minerals I talked about, every one of them, the plants also have a nutrient requirement for them, right? That's a living organism. They require micronutrients too, macronutrients as well, but they don't require selenium. It's the only one. So plants do what's called luxury accumulation. They will accumulate selenium in luxury amounts without any control because they don't have a requirement for it. All right? So if you live in a state that has high soil selenium, you'll produce plants that are high in selenium. And selenium has a narrow window for toxicity. So that's an issue I think we need to keep in mind. But for many parts of the country, soil selenium is very low and results in a poor selenium content of the forage. And clearly, the cows that are eating that forage respond. So this is selenium content of ground beef, samples taken from cow plants, processing plants in different parts of the United States. North Dakota, which is known to have selenium accumulating plants due to high soil selenium concentrations, that muscle tissue is high in selenium. You would expect that. And then you move into states that are known to have low soil selenium content, and the meat concentrations are low. So when we think about that then, these deficiencies that result from these micronutrients, we divide them up into two categories, primary deficiency and secondary deficiency. The primary deficiency is simply the result of consuming feedstuffs, forages, supplements that are low in those microminerals or macrominerals. All right? That's not very common. What's more common is the secondary deficiency, where the cow or calf consumes antagonists that tie up the elements of concern and cause a mineral deficiency. It's a secondary route. And that secondary deficiency is something that we're much more interested in. Here are the antagonists that we generally concern ourselves with: sulfur, molybdenum, iron, and aluminum. By far, sulfur is the most important. Now, I want to focus on these two, sulfur and molybdenum, in the next couple slides. Where do you get sulfur from? Here are the sources. High dietary sulfur can come into the diet from forages just due to atmospheric deposition. So rainwater has dilute sulfuric acid in it. Have you remember acid rain from the 60s and 70s? Well, we still have areas where we have a little bit of dilute sulfuric acid, particularly Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Kentucky. A lot of their forages will be quite high in sulfur from that source. And then sulfur-containing fertilizers can add to it. If you fertilize your grass, you might use ammonium sulfate as a source of nitrogen. Ammonium nitrate used to be more common, but particularly in rural areas, a lot of local fertilizer plants have a hard time inventorying ammonium nitrate because of the liability issues that are related to having ammonium nitrate on hand, as you might know. Ammonium sulfate is a good alternative, but it will contribute sulfur to the forage, and it's something to keep in mind. And then high sulfur supplements and high sulfur water. Now, I want to just tell you another one of the mystery issues in your water. Just because you can smell sulfur doesn't mean the water's high in sulfur. Remember that. And just because you can't smell it doesn't mean it's low in sulfur. When you smell the sulfur, what you're smelling is hydrogen sulfide that's volatilizing off of the surface of the water. And your nose can smell that in parts per trillion, and the total sulfur content might be very low. So I have people tell me all the time, I know my water's high in sulfur, you should smell it. That doesn't mean anything. You need to measure the total sulfur content. Generally, it's the sulfate that contributes to the high sulfur in the water. So here's some examples of high sulfur feedstuffs that many of us use as byproducts for supplementation of our cow herd. Look at these and add all of those sources up to estimate what your cows are consuming. And it's not hard to do. You can do it yourself. County Extension agent can help you, or a nutritionist from the university. Add them up. If it comes up to exceed 30 grams per day, that cow will not accumulate copper or selenium in her tissues. She won't do it. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad thing. You might go through 3 or 4 months, winter supplementation, she consumes 25 to 35 grams per day, but then you get off of the sulfur and she replenishes herself right away. But keep that in mind as just a rule of thumb. Here's some examples of ammonium sulfate fertilized pastures and the results that can come in pasture forage. 0.5% from 3 years of repeated application. Now, what happens when those cattle consume those high sulfur supplements? Here's an example of cattle consuming liquid molasses. They don't accumulate sulfur or selenium into their tissues, and it can impact performance over a long period of time. Here's an example of copper. Cattle consuming a high sulfur supplement, in this case molasses, and you can see they in the red line, they accumulate no copper in the tissues compared to consuming the same amount of copper through a corn-based supplement. All right? The difference is dramatic. Now, over a short period of time, it probably doesn't matter that much. So I want to just, I only have about a minute and a half, and I want to get into this next point related to sulfur and molybdenum. Many times people have said, you know, copper deficiency leads to reproductive failure. And that has been very inconclusive in the literature. What we know today is it's not the copper, but rather the sulfur and the molybdenum. And what happens is that sulfur and molybdenum combine to form a compound called a thiomolybdate. And you see that on the right side of this slide. And thiomolybdates can be absorbed into the bloodstream and they will bind copper. Now, if you feed copper in the rumen, that will bind the thiomolybdates and cause them not to be absorbed, and they'll be passed out of the animal. So they call it copper-responsive infertility. So it's really the molybdenum and the sulfur that's the problem, but we use the copper to overcome it, okay? And as this slide here shows you from this Kendall research, the bar clear to your right are thiomolybdates with no additional copper, and it's showing estrogen production from these granulosa cells. And so the last two slides or three slides I want to show you are just forms of mineral that you have available to you. So inorganic trace minerals are your common sulfate and oxide forms. There's a new form that's available now called hydroxychloride trace minerals. They are also inorganic trace minerals. They differ only in that they have a covalent bond between the metal and the hydroxy group, whereas other inorganic trace minerals are generally ionic bonds. The word organic trace minerals is not a good word. Many of you use the word chelated trace minerals, but organic trace minerals is the broad category of many different forms that are available to us that are simply a combination of the metal bound to a carbon-containing ligand. And so the research has been quite inconclusive. But one thing we do know is that young cattle and stressed cattle tend to respond to organic trace minerals. Mature, healthy cattle do not. And here's some examples of mature cows showing no benefit in pregnancy rates to organic trace minerals, whereas the young cows in their first and second lactation do. Jason Aloha at Colorado State showed the same thing in developing heifers in their first and second lactation, responding very well to organic trace minerals if they were young animals. And so in summary, I introduced to you the very quickly macrominerals and microminerals and explained that the microminerals, copper, zinc, and selenium, are those that we need to be the most concerned about. And also, antagonists are very important, particularly sulfur, and that sulfur and molybdenum interaction can be an issue. Those thiomolybdates impact reproduction. It's not copper directly, but rather the direct impact of the thiomolybdates on reproduction. Cattle are consuming high sulfur supplements more so than probably what they used to. There's more sources available to them. It's something that we should be concerned about. And organic sources of selenium and copper don't appear to overcome the sulfur antagonism. And organic sources of copper, zinc, and manganese have variable results. Generally, I tell people that young, stressed cattle will have a favorable response. Mature, healthy cattle, probably not. With that, I thank you for your attention and your time.